Have you ever wanted to play the perfect tabletop game, where story beats run smoothly, and there's no awkward pauses between dice rolls? Yeah, me too. But since that's impossible, I did the next best thing, and novelized my Witcher tabletop game to showcase the story in its cleanest form. The result is this podcast. I'm Jacob Gerstel, and this is Tales from the Witcher. Part audiobook, part actual play, part serialized adventure, and a whole new way to vicariously enjoy tabletop games. Welcome to the world of The Witcher, where monsters roam freely and the continent is once again at war. If you were hoping to follow the plight of Geralt of Rivia, however, I'm not going to be doing that. Instead, I offer you the story of a not-so-merry band of degenerates who are making their way across the continent. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Higher Consideration. 6. Ethramel stalked to the closest tavern. He'd had enough of Dwan telling him what to do for one day. Quite enough. He split from his company the moment they left the keep, as fast as his splinted leg would allow. He had half a mind to set the whole damn town of Undying on fire. That'd solve the curse in a flash. Ethramel put his hood back up and pulled his cloak a little closer to cover his elven sword. While such an act of power would indeed be satisfying, oh, to see the look on Radisson's face, he knew it would end with him swinging from a gibbet. Such was his people's curse, and it had lasted for more than 100 years. So Ethramel settled on getting drunk instead. "Ethramel, wait!" The elf turned to see Arthur running towards him.
"What is it?"
"I figured I'd accompany you to the tavern," Arthur said, "if that's indeed where you're going. It's my duty, anyway."
"Figured you would have gone to the brothel first."
Arthur kicked a loose bit of stone on the road.
"Would if I could, but Cedra and I drew straws to see who would perform there, and she won out."
Arthur's mood brightened quickly as they maneuvered through the soldiers and citizens. "I must say, I appreciate that thing you do."
"What thing that I do?"
"You know, that mummer's act with your voice and posture. Is acting a hobby of yours? To try different accents wherever you go and..." Arthur's face dawned with understanding.
"Ah, I understand. Ignore me."
"Already was." They stopped in front of a ramshackle tavern called the Horseshoe. Arthur nodded and said, "Well, for the good of Edern." The tavern was surprisingly busy, and all manner of humans and elder folk occupied the tables. Ethramel spotted two elves speaking quietly to one another at the bar, and he sat close to them. They were dressed in modest, if colorful, clothes. Each had a sword tucked into his belt. Not of elder make, like Ethramel's, but it looked like it could get the job done.
"Merchants, likely," the sorcerer thought.
The kind of elves who integrated into human society to survive. Ethramel both understood and despised such unsaid, those who would throw away thousands of years of elvish history and tradition just to save their own skins. They were an offshoot of his people's curse, a byproduct of cultural degradation. But still, they were elves, and that meant they were more likely to give him the time of day and answer his questions. So Ethramel signaled the barkeep over and ordered 3 glasses of vodka, asking that 2 be given to the integrated elves. They took the 2 glasses of vodka and turned to Ethramel, who held his own glass up.
"Well met," he said in elder speech.
The dark-haired elf also replied in elder speech.
"Well met. What's the occasion?"
"Always an occasion when one meets kin."
"In that case," the fair-haired elf said in elder speech,
"let's drink to kin."
They drank to kin.
"You new in town?" the dark-haired elf asked. "All alone?"
Ethramel thought to say that he was with 5 others, but stopped short. He glanced at Arthur, who was busy busking around the tavern. He thought of the others, and decided they weren't companions either, just travelers of convenience. And convenience was pushing it. After all, it wasn't convenient to take a plowing crossbow bolt to the thigh. They were a secretive lot as well, if Jeremiah's recent revelation proved anything. Who knows what else the 5 of them could be hiding? Secrets were dangerous. Secrets could get one killed. If anything, the Witcher and Craftsman and Troubadour and Doctor were bad luck for an elf just trying to survive. They weren't like him. Few were like Ethramel Untread.
"All alone," Ethramel said.
"Any advice for a newcomer?"
The fair-haired elf laughed. "My advice is to take the legend seriously. Don't stay out past sunset. You'll regret it."
"Just so."
Ethramel sipped his drink,
thinking of how to word his question. "Is there anyone you'd recommend I visit? Someone who's been around here a long time?" The two elves glanced at each other, before the dark-haired elf said, "What's your profession, kin?" Ethermel wiggled his fingers and said, "I'm a fisherman." The elves laughed. The dark-haired elf nodded and said, "Right, so are we." There was a subtext to their conversation, as there often was when elves talked near Dwan. A message unspoken, for fear of persecution from the Round Ears. Subtext was always safer. The question, Ethermel wondered, was what his new kin were trying to tell him. They could be Scoia'tael, Ethermel thought. He had some sympathy for the elven guerrilla fighters that were currently waging war against the Northern Kingdoms, but he wasn't particularly interested in their plight at this moment. Rather, Ethermel was hoping to find a sorceress. He was keen to learn more about this signet, and whether he actually still lived in his tower in the swamp. He hoped the two elves understood that subtext, in the same way the elves hoped Ethermel understood theirs. But neither could say as much outright, so they had to be comfortable with ambiguity. The Unsaid were used to it. "If you're looking for someone who's been around a long time," the fair-haired elf said, "you'll want to speak with Enna. She runs the Golden Blouse, the town brothel. Kind woman. Treats her girls and boys well." "Tell her Adro and Raneth sent you, if you'd like," the dark-haired elf said. "Might get you in the door." It certainly was ambiguous, but it would have to do. The sorcerer nodded. "My name is Ethermel Untred. It was a pleasure meeting you." "Likewise." The dark-haired Adro finished his glass and stood up. The fair-haired Raneth followed. "Maybe we'll see you around Longkoff, fisherman." Ethermel shot back the rest of his drink, ordered two more glasses of vodka, and watched Arthur capture the hearts of the barflies of Horseshoe. When he had enough of a buzz built, he left the troubadour and made his way to the Golden Blouse, cursing softly with each step on his wounded leg. "When in doubt, go to the brothel," Ethermel thought. "Sorceresses flock to them like flies to honey, and the most enterprising ones end up owning them, like that Dwan sorceress in Vengerberg." The Golden Blouse wasn't hard to find, it turned out. It was the only building near Market Street with three scantily clad and well-endowed women, and one scantily clad and well-endowed man, loitering at the front. They tried their best to coax passers-by into sampling their wares. Ethermel approached the one she-elf of the bunch and said in elder speech, "Is Enna in?" "Depends on who's asking," the elf replied in elder speech. "A man with a large sack of coin." The elf approached and ran a finger down Ethermel's chest. "Well, I can help relieve you of that. You don't need Enna." Ethermel thought to take the elf up on her offer, but the sober side of his brain won out, and he shook his head. "Maybe after. I'd like to speak with her. I have some business to ask about." He paused and added, "Adro and Raneth sent me." The elf pouted, but motioned for Ethermel to follow. The Golden Blouse looked like the interior of most well-funded taverns, only with far more men and women giving lap dances. The elf told Ethermel to wait at the bar. Ethermel ordered a beer to keep the buzz from subsiding. He heard music and laughter from the corner of the brothel. He turned to see Cedra sitting and playing, a lithe woman with hair like hyacinth resting on her lap. The troubadour winked at the sorcerer before turning her attention back to the woman. "I heard someone wanted to see me," Ethermel heard from behind the bar. He turned to see a woman of classical features, with blonde hair, bright green eyes, and bright red lipstick, and pointed ears. His hope of Enna being a sorceress, already a gamble, were dashed. An elf with the power was an extreme rarity. Ethermel could count the number of elven sorcerers and sorceresses on two hands, including himself. "I normally would have refused out of principle, but then I heard the person asking was Unsaid, and mentioned Adro and Raneth to boot, so I made an exception." Ethermel frowned. "I believe Adro and Raneth misunderstood my subtext," he thought. Still, it wasn't a total loss. Enna was likely over a century old, and she may know a thing or two about Signet. Only one way to find out. "Is there some place we can talk in private?" he asked. Enna gave a bubbly laugh. "A bold request, love, and not one I grant often. Perhaps you can make an exception. I won't take up too much time, and I promise it's related to business, not pleasure." "Pleasure is my business, love, but I understand." Enna motioned towards the stairs. "Come, then." Enna led Ethermel down a long hallway with doors lining each side. All were closed, and most had rather interesting sounds coming out of them. "It's been too plowing long," Ethermel thought glumly. Enna's office was surprisingly small and bare, with nothing but a desk and two chairs. Ethramel sat in the smaller chair, careful not to bump his splinted leg against the desk. "What can I do to help you, then?" she asked. "I heard you've been around a long time," Ethramel said. "At least, Adro and Raneth said so." Enna nodded. "And Adro and Raneth are typically good judges of character. They speak the truth. I've been here a long time." "Then what can you tell me about Signet?" Enna stiffened, but quickly returned to her languid slouch. This did not escape Ethramel's notice, who himself was practiced, as Arthur so eloquently pointed out, at mumming. "And why," Anna said slowly, "do you ask? Hoping to lift his curse?" Ethramel shook his head. He cared little for solving Dwan problems, but a vengeful sorcerer interested him. Maybe he'd be vengeful enough to take an elf as an apprentice. Stranger things have happened, and Ethramel dreamed of expanding his power. "Color me curious. Curiosity costs coin, love." Ethramel produced a sack of coins that jingled as it hit the desk. Anna smiled. "I'll need a taste first." Ethramel pushed 30 marks towards the she-elf. "You'll get more than a taste if you're as detailed as possible." Anna took the coins and nodded. "Well, once upon a time." 7. Witcher. The gray-haired woman who stormed out of Radisson's office was now storming towards Zevo. He stepped to the side of the street to avoid the crowds.
"Yes?"
"Ah, I thought so," the woman said with a snap of her fingers. "I only got a glimpse of you as I left my office, but you can't hide those yellow eyes. Well, I, in your case."
"Alderwoman Lassa," Zevo said. "Nice to meet you."
The woman rested her hands on her hips.
"You know who I am?"
"I should hope so. I've been asking about you for half an hour. Been bothering all the guards about it."
"And what," Lassa said, "did the guards say?"
"Mainly that you have a habit of disappearing when you're angry, and that, if the anger persists, you have a tendency to make rash decisions."
"Those gossips! I'll flog them in the town square!"
"Unless people would see that as a rash decision."
"They probably would."
"Ah, then plow it. Fancy a drink?"
"You read my mind."
Lassa took Zevo to a tavern off Main Street named Stonework. She ordered 2 pints of beer and sat the Witcher down in a corner table.
"I'll get right to it. I can guess why you were looking for me, and it's the same reason I was looking for you. Radisson asked you to lift Signet's curse, didn't he?"
"He did."
"And will you?"
Zevo sipped his beer.
"I told him I'd look into it."
"Did he say how much he'd pay?"
"Not yet."
"Good, good." Lass's eyes flashed, and Zevo took it as a warning sign.
"I'd like to make a simple request. Don't lift Signet's curse."
Zevo didn't betray his surprise. Like the elf, he was capable of playing a simpleton. He had the dull-looking face for it.
And why would the Alderwoman not want to lift a 100-year-old curse on her town?
"I'm sure you've also wondered why, after a century, the curse remains over Loncough."
"It's crossed my mind."
"Several sorcerers and witchers have offered to remove the curse over the years, and every time they're refused by the Alderman. Do you know why?"
"No, but I'm sure you'll tell me."
"Because the curse, paradoxically, keeps this town safe. Nilfgaard has invaded Edirne twice in recent memory, and twice Loncough has been passed over, despite our thriving trade with Mahakam. No one wants to conquer the town of Undying."
"Does Radisson share your thinking?"
Lassa spat on the sawdusted floor. "That upjump son of a bitch comes in from Aldersburg and thinks he could dictate orders in Loncough. He doesn't care what happens to this town. He just cares about having safe passage at night. But he'll leave in a week in one way or another, and if the curse is lifted, we won't be safe from the Black Cloaks, or any future threats. So just tell Radisson that you've investigated the curse and that it can't be lifted. Or lie and say you lifted the curse, collect your pay, and be on your way. Radisson doesn't have the resources to pursue you." Zevo rolled the mug between his hands. He was, he realized, rapidly approaching a crossroad.
"Tell me everything you know about the curse."
"Does that mean you'll take my offer?"
"It means I'm asking you to tell me everything you know about the curse."
Lassa stared Zevo down for a moment before throwing her arms up. "King of the Wild Hunt take all you witchers. Fine, I'll share what I know. But in return, I ask you give my offer consideration. Fair?"
Zevo nodded.
"I assume you've heard the story about Signet and his committee?"
Zevo nodded.
"Then I'll get this out of the way now. My great-grandfather was the alderman responsible for the committee's death. He rounded them up, roped them together, and ordered them executed after they repented and publicly turned their back on Signet."
"Running Loncough's a family business, eh?"
Lassa shrugged.
"I suppose. if only because no one else wants the responsibility. My grandfather was alderman, as was my father. After me, who knows? The core of the story you've heard is true, minus the obvious fantastical elements, including, sad to say, my great-grandfather's motives. The committee was doing little more than garnering mundane political influence in Lonkoff. My great-grandfather and the Edonian lord, this was before the lord fled, feared what might happen if a sorcerer and his apprentices gained power. For my great-grandfather, it was fear of the unknown. For the lord, it was fear of losing control. Zeva waited to see if Lassa had anything more to say before asking, "And how do you know all this?" "My great-grandfather told my grandfather, who told my father, who told me. I imagine the guild got the better of my great-grandfather, eventually. It's gotten the better of me before. I'm ashamed of his decisions, Witcher, and would do anything to rectify my family's mistake. Anything except lift the curse. Keeping Lonkoff safe is too important." "I understand." Zeva pushed himself up from the table. "Thanks for the drink." "Wait, you'll give my offer consideration, yes?" Zeva nodded, unsure if he was lying or not. The sun hadn't reached its apex when the Witcher stepped outside, dodging a wagon laden with metal pots that rolled past. He reached into his bag and pulled out the map Radisson had given him. It was crude, but it pointed the way to Signet's keep. He decided to leave Diabol stabled and left Lonkoff on foot. Zeva found an overgrown trail that, he imagined, must have been well-maintained a century ago. He followed it, not moving too quick or too slow. There was time left in the day. "And I'll stay out longer if needed," he thought. "I don't fear the night." The Witcher was glad his companions hadn't followed him along this time. Zeva came upon the keep an hour later. It was not dissimilar in design to Radisson's, with four turrets, simple stone walls, and large wooden doors that no doubt led into a courtyard. The single tower that rose from the keep was set into the foothills behind it. And most notably, the entire keep rested on a raised stone foundation, perhaps 3 meters high, with a single staircase leading up to the wooden doors. And in front of the doors stood three knights, covered head to toe in plate armor. Each had a greatsword pointing to the ground, with their hands resting on the pommel. All three stood stock still. Zevo's bare medallion hummed consistently. "Draugrs, maybe," the Witcher thought. He picked up a stone and tossed it at one of the suits of armor. It bounced off the middle one's breastplate, but there was no reaction. He threw a second rock at the red double doors. No reaction. Zeva rounded the keep and eyed the stone platform and walls. They were smooth, with no easy way to climb. He dug into his bag and found a length of rope. Not useful on its own, but... The Witcher smiled as an idea entered his mind. It was a cold, calculating smile. The smile of a killer. The smile of a professional. 8. "Not bad," Fedin, the barber surgeon, said. Carmagnola wiped his bloodied hands with an already bloodied rag. "I know. He should recover with a few weeks' rest, but I think his sword-swinging days are over." Fedin adjusted his spectacles and looked down at the etherized soldier. Next to him, on a dirty piece of cloth, laid his severed forearm, black at the fingertips from infection. "I dare say I'd agree. We'll move him to the recovery ward." Each ward, Carmagnola had quickly discovered, was a requisitioned house on one of the quieter streets in Lonkoff. Well, it was one of the quieter streets. The street was now a hive of activity. Medics and surgeons and field dressers were moving wounded soldiers to and from each house, based, Carmagnola assumed, on need and necessity. He had found Fedin in the surgery ward, muttering over a stack of papers in his hand. He was a slight man, and unassuming in a comforting way. Carmagnola thought he had the look of a reliable professional. Fedin read the note Radisson wrote and wasted no time putting Carmagnola to work. He gave him a few small tasks at first, diagnosing certain illnesses or injuries, but before long he performed an amputation, under the barber surgeon's supervision. Necessity demanded it. There were too many soldiers to treat. "Tell me," Fedin said as two field dressers lifted the etherized soldier onto a makeshift stretcher. "Where did you study medicine?" "Oxenfurt." Then Carmagnola added, just in case, "In the Kingdom of Redania." Fedin grinned in a way that made his face look wider than it was. "Is that so? I studied there too. Maybe a good decade before you, but still." Could have figured that, Carmagnola thought, not out of derision for the barber surgeon or Oxenfurt, but simply because it was one of the few non-magical academies in the Northern Kingdoms. Any Nordling who knew a lick about medicine, or philosophy, or astronomy, or the arts, likely studied at Oxenfurt. Still, Carmagnola matched Fedin's grin. Small world. So it seems. Fedden nodded. You've more than proven yourself to me, and you've earned a bit of a break after that grisly surgery. Go spend an hour or two in the recovery ward and relieve one of the poor orderlies. Fedden adjusted his spectacles and looked out the window. The sun's likely to set shortly after that, so be sure you find a place to stay for the night. Then come back first thing tomorrow morning, but not before sunrise. Do you understand? I understand. The recovery ward was quieter than the surgery ward, though many soldiers were awake and chatting and playing Gwent in small groups. Carmignola relieved a grateful orderly and did what was asked of him, adjusting pillows and blankets or feeding soldiers lukewarm borscht. Carmignola did these tasks mechanically, not because he didn't care, but because his mind wandered back to Oxenfurt. He thought about how seemingly small decisions had the power to completely alter one's life. The choices men make live long after them. Was it Vedard, that ageless and towering presence in Carmignola's childhood, who told him that? It must have been. Carmignola didn't know what that meant as a child. He still didn't know what it meant when, as a teenager, he rescued a bloodied 16-year-old boy from the side of the road. How was he to know then that that act would lead to a fully paid education? And from Oxenfurt sprung 1,000 more choices, most seemingly small, that placed Carmignola in a recovery ward in the town of Undying. And is this where I want to be? The doctor wondered. The thought troubled him. So Carmignola was grateful when a wounded soldier called him over. He was a ruddy-faced man, with a swath of bandages covering his shoulder and chest. The man and the woman lying next to him were similarly wounded.
"Could I trouble you for water for me and my mates?"
he asked in a raspy voice. "But of course." Carmignola banished all thoughts about choices and their consequences as he secured a water skin and handed it to the soldier. The soldier reached for the skin. That's when Carmignola noticed the black son of Nilfgaard tattooed under his arm. The soldier saw Carmignola's eyes wander and quickly put his arm down. He drank deep from the water skin and cleared his throat. "Thanks." Carmignola hunkered next to the soldier as he handed the skin to his companions. He said, "I'm going to preface this by saying you're in a house of healing, and as long as you stay, no harm will come to you. But I must ask how you ended up here." The soldier's two companions looked at him, worry stamped on their creased faces. The soldier set his jaw and said, "We were conscripted, like everyone else. I mean how you wound up on the wrong side of the battlefield." The ruddy-faced soldier looked down at his bandages. Hiding who we were seemed the better alternative to getting our throats slit. Carmignola nodded. That was a distinct possibility if Radisson of Braithwaite heard that there were black cloaks in the town. At the very least, they would be tortured for information they likely didn't have. "I understand. What are your names?"
"Drern. This is Lurwetta and Mark."
"Drern,"
the man named Mark said in a harsh whisper. "The doctor knows. No sense in hiding it now out of fear. No honor in it either." Drern looked at Carmignola with steely determination. "So what will you do, doctor?" Carmignola matched Drern's gaze. "As I said, this is a house of healing, and no harm will come to you here. That being said, would you three like something a little stronger than water?" Drern looked to Lurwetta and Mark, the Nilfgaardians. Drern nodded and said, "Something stronger sounds fine. Thank you, doctor." Later, Carmignola would wonder if noticing the tattoo was also a small choice, and if the consequences that followed were fitting. But such thoughts would come later. For now, Carmignola focused on cutting water with a splash of ether, trying hard not to think of anything at all. 9. Jeremiah found the golden blouse to his liking. It was certainly better than any place he'd stayed since fleeing to Edirne. The sumptuous decor was the main reason, of course. All the women flitting about were just a bonus. Of course. Grammet the blacksmith put his armor on Jeremiah's shoulder. "Not bad, eh?" Jeremiah nodded, trying to focus on the sumptuous decor and not the sumptuous workers. He saw Cedra being led up the stairs by a young woman with short, hyacinth-like black hair.
"Aye, could be worse," the craftsman said.
Grammet grinned. He was a mountain of muscle, with dark skin and a full beard. Jeremiah had reported to him at the forge earlier in the day, and Grammet wasted no time putting the craftsman to the test. Jeremiah wasted no time impressing Grammet with his abilities. Grammet quickly promoted Jeremiah to the number 2 weapon and armorsmith. By the time the sun started to set, Grammet had promised Jeremiah a drink. Jeremiah accepted, of course, though he had to admit he didn't find the work hard. Edonian designs were simple, and he knew most of them by heart already, by nature of his training. That's not to say he didn't find the work enjoyable. He appreciated the fast-paced bustle of the forge,
with lines of soldiers coming in with dented armor and blunted swords, and leaving shortly after with satisfied looks on their faces. The excess weapon and armor, Jeremiah noticed, were put in a storage room attached to the back of the forge. Only Grammont had the key, and only he went in and out. The lines of soldiers thinned out after lunch, and Grammont closed the forge down by early afternoon. He told Jeremiah it was better safe than sorry. The Loncoffian workday, it appeared, ended with plenty of daylight to spare. Jeremiah spent the rest of the afternoon exploring Market Street, which rapidly dwindled to a few hawkers desperate to squeeze the last bit of coin out of the day. When he was done, he met up with the blacksmith, who asked, "Do you like brothels?" Jeremiah grinned.
"Do I look like a man who would?"
Grammont crooked a thumb towards the golden blouse. "Well, let's get inside, then. The guards will throw you in jail if they catch you out right before sunset." Jeremiah accepted his drink from Grammont at the bar, said hello to Arthur of Garamore, who decided to bed at the Golden Blouse for the evening, and ate a modest meal. He spoke to Grammont about the forge and the best ways to temper steel. Grammont, more than once, wondered aloud how gnomes could give their blades such a fine edge. Jeremiah wished he knew. More soldiers and townsfolk came in as the sun kissed the top of the Mahakam Mountains. Jeremiah thanked Grammont and approached one of the brothel workers sitting at the bar. They haggled over price.
"Why not?"
Jeremiah thought, as he was led by the hand up the stairs.
"A man deserves to unwind after serving his kingdom."
10. For the second time in a day, Zevo found himself standing outside Signet's keep. There was enough daylight left, but the Witcher knew that would rapidly change. He had lost an hour and a half, not to mention a few marks, returning to Loncoff to buy a meat hook. But he figured it better than trying to fight the three magical knights guarding the door. Zevo had tied the meat hook to the length of rope he carried. He circled to the side of the keep, out of the knight's sight, and gave it a light toss. He was pleased when the hook clung to the top of the stone platform, itself not much taller than Zevo, on which the keep rested. He used the rope to haul himself up, pausing at the top and waiting to hear the familiar clang of armor rushing towards him. He didn't hear anything, and didn't see any knights round the corner. That was good. Now the real test, Zevo thought, as he looked up at the stone wall, which was significantly taller than him. He gave the grapple a few precursory swings and tossed it up. He tugged on the rope and felt the hook wriggle like a loosened tooth. But it held. Zevo sighed and planted a foot on the base of the wall. "I hate sorcerers," he thought. Zevo climbed the wall, placing one foot in front of the other and trying not to look down. He did, of course, but pressed on. After an agonizing minute that felt like an hour, he hopped over the crenellation and landed on the wooden allure behind it. He unhooked the grapple and looked down. There were no signs of the knights. That was good. The Witcher peered down into the courtyard and saw what once might have been a lovely, well-tended garden. If it was, its time had long since passed. Dead trees and rose bushes and flower beds littered the courtyard, clumped between untended weeds and elephant grass. The stone paths that weaved between these dead clusters were cracked. Zevo found a wooden stairwell leading him into the courtyard. He feared each rotting step would break beneath his weight. At the back of the courtyard, nearly set into the foothills behind it, was a square, gray stone tower, 4 stories tall by the look of it. An unassuming wooden door with a rusted brass handle was the only way in. Zevo tried his luck and found it unlocked. That was not good. The medallion buzzed against Zevo's chest. "I know," he said through clenched teeth. "Shut up." The Witcher, no stranger to sorcerer's towers, hesitated. But he went inside. He entered a large antechamber. Like the garden, it might once have been welcoming. There were faded and moth-eaten tapestries hanging on the walls, and a banquet table that looked like it hadn't been used in a century. To the right were a set of stairs, stone this time, which Zevo took. The Witcher moved quietly, as the stairs wrapped to the left like a serpent. It ended in another plain wooden door. Zevo opened it slowly. He nearly took a step, but the spike from his medallion stopped him. He glanced down to see a glowing blue sigil carved into the floor. It pulsed rhythmically, like a heartbeat. Zevo took a deep breath and stepped over the sigil, waiting to lose a leg in the process. He did not, and he quickly moved away from the ward. He stood in a room that was nearly as bare as the antechamber below it, save for the bookshelves lining the walls and the single desk in front of a small window that gave view of the marsh below. The sun shined weakly through it. He was running out of time. Zevo would have crossed to the stairs at the other end of the room immediately, but a strange twitch of his medallion led him to a red book that laid on the desk. It was remarkable in that it wasn't moldy or shredded like every other book in the room. Sevo picked it up and flipped through it. He stopped on a page in the middle, in which the bard reflects the moonlight, pale, like your skin, and no less lovely. Blind to the buzzing of the mosquitoes, which thirst for our life. Blind to all but you, and your golden hair, your poetry, and bad poetry at that. Sevo closed the book with disgust, but put it into his bag. There was something magical about it. He could sense that the moment he touched it. Maybe the elf would know. Sevo rounded another set of stairs that ended at another unassuming door. He opened it slowly and entered an alchemical lab, if the dusty beakers and boxes of molded reagents were any indication. At the center of the room, bolted to the ground, was a metal rod with a metal ball on top. The room smelled like disinfectant. Sevo stifled a cough and hugged the wall, keeping his distance from the metal pole at the center, which gave off a tinny buzz like a fly in your ear. The lab reminded him of Stesco Dror, the conductor of so many experiments, that sorcerer of endless curiosity, researcher of lost knowledge, he who... Sevo was grateful his medallion twitched again. The spike against his chest brought him out of the memories, and with control practiced over a century, he cleared all thoughts. He approached one of the boxes on the table. It contained the bones of a small animal, cat, most like, but it gave off the same magical sensation as the book of poetry, so Sevo took it too, and he moved up the next flight of stairs. The Witcher heard noises behind this wooden door. Not shouts or invocations, which was good, but muttering. Sevo did not draw his weapon, but he was prepared to. The final room was a bedroom, and a sparse one at that. The bed in the corner was unmade, and the rug on the floor was rumpled like discarded clothing. Next to the window, leaning against the wall, was a greatsword. And on the other side of the room, sitting at a desk and writing, was an old man. His lank white hair was nearly as tangled as his long white beard, and his red robe looked faded and stained. "Signet," Sevo said. The man at the desk, who looked every bit his age, did not react. He kept writing and muttering to himself. Sevo took a cautious step forward and spoke again. "Signet." More writing and muttering. "Signet."
"Huh?"
The old man looked up and saw Sevo for the first time.
"Ah, yes. Hello. Fine sounds, are they not?"
Sevo didn't hear anything. Signet spoke in a creaky voice, and slow, as if forming each syllable was a mighty feat. "I've come to speak with you." Signet nodded, then returned to his writing. Sevo did not let his guard down. He knew what sorcerers were capable of. "I'm a witcher. Do you know what a witcher is?" Signet continued writing, then looked up and said,
"Of course. Witchers mate with witches, and their children become warlocks."
Sevo ground his teeth. "Not quite. Did you cast the curse on Lonkoff?"
"Did you know the conjunction of the spheres brought vampires into this plane of existence?"
the old man asked. Sevo did know that, and he didn't particularly care at the moment. "Signet, I..." "You won't get anything out of him." Sevo turned and drew his silver sword in a flash. The voice was close, but he didn't hear anyone enter the room. He saw a man standing near the window, though man might have been charitable. What stood before Sevo was in the shape of a man who wore a suit of silver armor. But all the man's flesh, his uncovered head, the slits in his armor, his hands, was smoky and ethereal black. "A Draugr," Sevo said. He did not lower his sword. Draugrs were dangerous, wraiths imbued with power and intelligence. The Witcher didn't fancy fighting in such cramped corridors, with a doddering sorcerer to his back. The Draugr nodded. His voice carried an ethereal sound, as if it continually echoed. "Yes, and you're a Witcher. Here to lift the curse, I presume." "I don't even know if there is a curse." Sevo motioned towards Signet, who had returned to scribbling in his journal, either unaware of or ignoring the conversation. "That's what I came to ask him." "Well, you won't get answers from Signet." "What happened to him?" "The same thing that happens to all of us," the Draugr said. "Even those who live unnaturally long lives. Age has caught up to him. His mind is not what it used to be." Sevo nodded. "You one of the committee?" "Why do you think that?"
because draugrs are brought about from intense hatred and vicious acts. An unjust execution would fit that. The draugr nodded. Yes, I'm one of the six. My name is Dybind. Zevo of Kavir. Where are the other five? Dybind shrugged. His armor almost seemed to float off of him. Somewhere. I'm the only one who stays here with Signet. The others find it too sad. You tend to him? Someone has to, Dybind said. Zevo laughed. Funny. I fail to see the humor in any of this. I just meant, Zevo said, the dead are taking care of the living. The room was quiet, except for Signet's muttering. The sun continued to set. Are you here to kill Signet? Dybind asked. Zevo glanced at the old man. Would it lift the curse if I did? Not if you do it right now. Would you attack me if I tried? If you tried. Zevo nodded. Dybind stepped by the window, and Zevo noticed the greatsword that rested near it glimmer. The sun is about to set. Come see Signet's handiwork yourself. The Witcher watched.
That'll do it for this episode of Tales from The Witcher. This podcast is written and produced by Jacob Gerstel. The Witcher novels are by Andrzej Sapkowski, The Witcher games are by CD Projekt Red, and The Witcher tabletop RPG is by R. Talsorian Games. The music is by Eric Matias at soundimage.org. Be sure to leave a rating and a review, and to spread the word of this podcast far and wide. You can follow the podcast at TalesWitcherPod on X or at talesfromthewitcher.buzzsprout.com. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you again next week.